Tonight, our subject is the productivity theory of wages. All right, now, what we did last week, last part of the class, was give an exposition and also a critique of the Marxian exploitation theory, culminating in its contemporary influence, which I pointed out can be found as the basis of the economic program of the so-called liberals for the last 150 years or so. All of their major positions are straight out of the exploitation theory, and the way that they believe the different measures work is straight out of the exploitation theory. The key was in recognizing that where the exploitation theory is very influential is in people's beliefs as to how laissez-faire capitalism would operate. Not the present-day system of tremendous government intervention, but a system without that intervention. And most people believe, with virtually no opposition, that if we didn't have minimum wage laws and unions, wages would sink to the minimum subsistence level, hours would extend to the maximum humanly endurable, and the conditions of work would be nightmarish, and children would be working in the mines, the whole story. And it's generally thought that the only thing that stands between us and that kind of nightmare is government intervention. And so government intervention gets the credit for the improvement, and the nature of capitalism gets the blame for the terrible conditions of the past. And I pointed out that not only labor legislation, but also ideas pertaining to taxation and government spending come directly from the exploitation theory. It's thought that the capitalists are exploiters, and thus that taxing their incomes to the hilt is no great crime at all, that it just represents taking back loot that they've expropriated from the masses. And then if that loot can be distributed in various social welfare programs, public housing, public education, government-provided medical care, whatever, that all that represents giving back to the victims of exploitation some of what's been taken from them. And this is how I believe the so-called liberals view things, how the mainstream media views things, how the great bulk of today's intellectuals view things. I don't know if you have a different opinion on this or not. Do you think this is an accurate portrayal? Yes, Mr. Severin.
I may not be so extreme,
yeah.
But at the same time, may feel that if there was no guidance there, or no one, no big brother looking out for my welfare, I might feel that I can't compete with, you know, these big giants. I have to, you know, fend for my children, and who's to say that they're not going to exploit me because of that?
All right, well, that's the basic
idea. They're the ones with the money.
That's the basic idea, that other people with money, they have the power to exploit you. And so, in the name of that belief, on the basis of that belief, people think that all this interference is in the vital self-interest of the average person. And my point at the moment is simply that this is the prevailing belief. Now, there are some people who think it's unfair for anyone to challenge this, that it's one-sided if you disagree. But if this is all you hear, well, that's balanced and even, and so there's no problem with that. It's only if someone were to disagree with this that then there must be something wrong. What I want to start to present under the name of the productivity theory of wages is a mutually exclusive positive explanation, a mutually exclusive explanation of the determination of wages, and we'll apply it to the economic history of the last 200 years or so. The only negative aspect is going to be at the introduction. where it's necessary to make some observations concerning the plausibility of the exploitation theory. What makes it seem plausible? And I think there are two elements, each of which considered up to a point in its own right is true, but from which very erroneous inferences are drawn. And the way I put it here in point one, plausibility of the exploitation theory based on ideas of worker need and employer greed. Now, let me elaborate what I mean by worker need and employer greed. Well, the worker need aspect is the idea that the average worker is vitally dependent on his wages. He needs to be paid wages within a fairly short period of time. Very few people can live without earning some income for very long. And there are certainly many, many people living from paycheck to paycheck. And many, many of those who are not living from paycheck to paycheck, well, maybe they have a few months savings, possibly a year's savings. But the great majority of people need to earn wages fairly soon. And so they absolutely need to work. Otherwise, they're threatened with starvation, or would be if they couldn't turn to the welfare system, if they couldn't get money from the government in under one form or another, whether it's welfare or for some time unemployment insurance. It's thought that without these things, many, many people, vast numbers of people, would be threatened with literal starvation. And in the light of that, it's thought the workers have a desperate need to work and soon. And if they had no better alternative, people would be willing to work for minimum subsistence. Probably the majority of workers around the world are still working for minimum subsistence. If you look in places like China and India, the great majority of people working there are working at or very close to minimum subsistence. And virtually everybody would be willing to work for such a low wage if he had no better alternative. If there were no better alternative, people would be willing to work for the merest pittance sufficient to keep them alive. And they'd be willing to work extremely long, as long and hard as they could. Just think, what would you be prepared to do rather than die of starvation? Well, you'd be prepared to work as long and as hard as you can for anything that enabled you not to starve. And so it's thought on that basis that the wage earners are open to their wages being driven down in the absence of some kind of protection. That's one aspect of it. And then on the other side, there's this element that I refer to as employer greed. And what that means is that employers, just like any other buyer, prefer to pay less rather than more. When you buy something, you'd rather pay less than more. And similarly, when employers employ labor, they'd rather pay lower wages than higher wages. Every buyer would rather pay less than more. Now, it's thought that if you turn the parties loose without government interference, that on the one side we'll have the pressure of employer greed, the employers trying to pay less rather than more. On the other side, the workers' willingness, if they had no better alternative, to accept minimum subsistence. And the way I visualize this is, imagine we had a hollow cylinder, and up on top of it, for the moment, there's wages and the present standard of living resting up here on the top of this hollow cylinder. But what's holding these things up at their present height in the minds of most people is a form of scaffolding constituted by government intervention. Above all, the labor unions reinforced by the minimum wage laws, the maximum hours laws, child labor laws, and more recently, occupational health and safety legislation, one thing and another. And it's thought that if we abolish this government intervention, in effect it would be pulling away the scaffolding, and then the self-interest of the employers would be like a lead ball going through this hollow cylinder, and wages and the standard of living would be driven down, and there would be no resistance to the fall, short of wages being at minimum subsistence and hours being at the maximum. And only at the point of minimum subsistence, it's believed, would you have any real resistance, because at that point, people would take the attitude, if they're going to die of starvation, well, perhaps it's preferable to do so resting under a tree rather than toiling in a factory. Now, have I given an unfair account of how beliefs stand on the subject? I think this is the way most people see it. All right, what I want to do is begin by showing the absolute irrelevance of these two elements, worker need and employer greed. As I say, each of them considered alone is true. If workers had no better alternatives, they would be willing to work for minimum subsistence and the whole rest of it. And the self-interest of employers does imply that they prefer to pay less rather than more. So these propositions are both true. But what I will show is wrong is the inference that's drawn from them, which is that if we turn the parties loose, that the self-interest of the employers could succeed in driving wages to minimum subsistence, that the workers would have no better alternative. I'll show that they would, in fact, have vastly better alternatives, and the self-interest of employers would not operate to drive wages to minimum subsistence, even though they do prefer to pay less rather than more. Now, I make the statement both of these factors are irrelevant, and then I refer to the cases of the used car and the art auction. Well, let me start with the used car, and this will be designed to show that the willingness of the workers to accept minimum subsistence is actually totally irrelevant to the wages they have to accept. And I'll start with the case of the used car, because that I don't think will engender much emotion. Simply imagine someone, he has a late model car in excellent condition, a very good car, and he's paid a substantial sum for it, and he's working for a company that he plans to make his career with. And they offer him a promotion, and the promotion requires that he live for several years in Manhattan, in the heart of New York City. Now, I don't know if you know anything about driving conditions and parking conditions in Manhattan, but to garage a car there is comparable to the monthly rent on an apartment in many parts of the country. I think now it may be $40 or $50 a day. In much of Manhattan. And if you don't garage your car, your only alternative is to park it on the street, but that's very, very difficult to do. Many streets are totally closed to parking. Most of the ones that allow it require that every other day the street be cleared for several hours so that the sanitation trucks can come through and clean the streets. But if you were willing to, if you had the ability to drive into a spot, let's say an hour before it becomes legal, and sit in your car, so if a cop comes by, you can just drive it away and not get a ticket, well, then you'll find a spot. But if you don't have an hour to spend every other day or more to arrange a parking spot on the street, and you simply can't afford to garage the car, then that means you simply can't take the car to New York with you. You must get rid of the car. All right, now, if here you are, you've decided you want this job in New York, how much would you be willing to sell your very good car for, that you've paid a substantial sum for, if you had no better alternative?
As much as it's worth.
Well, how much would you be willing?
As much as you can get.
Well, how about how little would you be willing to take if that was all you could get?
What you paid for it.
Okay, so here you are, let's say you paid $25,000, and there's some depreciation on it. So here you are, you're saying, okay, if I can't get what I consider the fair value, $20,000, then what am I gonna do? Am I gonna cancel the move to New York.
So you want the job that bad, represents?
Yeah, you're committed. You've decided your future career depends on making this move.
You might be willing to give it away.
Well, in those conditions, you'd be willing, if you had no better alternative, to give the car away for nothing. If you're definitely going to go, and you can't take it with you, you've got to get rid of it. So if you had no better alternative, you'd give it away. You'd give it away for nothing. And if you couldn't find anyone to take it, if everyone else that you knew was moving also, then you'd be willing, if necessary, to pay a tow truck company to come and take it off your hands, take it to the dump, if there were no better alternative. So you'd be willing either to give it away for free or actually pay to have it taken off your hands. Now, I go into this case because I want to develop the point that even though you as a seller might be willing to take nothing for it just to get it off your hands, you will certainly not have to. A similar case would be, imagine you own a grand piano. Up to now you've lived in a large house, but now you're moving into a small condo and there's simply no room for the grand piano. How much would you be willing to take for the grand piano if you couldn't get a better offer? Nothing. Again, give it away or pay to have it removed. But my point is going to be that even though you're willing to do that, you do not have to, and we'll see that the same applies to the wage earners. And here we'll start to see why. Now, let's start with the diagram on the left. And what we're going to assume is that this point A on this line SS, that this represents the number of previously owned automobiles put up for sale and sold in a given period of time. And we're going to make the assumption that each and every seller of a used car, each and every individual who's selling his car, is, for whatever reason, in the same position as our hypothetical guy who's taking the promotion to go to New York. We're going to make the assumption that all of the sellers of these cars, all of the sellers of the cars that collectively amount to the quantity A, depicted by this vertical line SS, this is the supply. We're going to assume that all of them, if necessary, would give them away for nothing or even pay to have them taken off their hands. Notice I have this supply line extending below the origin. It goes into negative territory. That indicates that the sellers of this quantity would be willing, if necessary, to pay to have them taken off their hands. So they'd sell them at a negative price. But of course, they would like to get a better price. They want to get the best price they can. And that rises from something in below zero on up far beyond the top of this line up to the next floor, the top of this building. There's no limit to how high a price people would like to get if only they could. So here we are. We're indicating a common case where the sellers attach no personal valuation to what they're selling, and they're prepared to sell it from zero or even a negative number on up without any fixed limit. Now, what's going to determine the price that they can obtain? Is it going to be zero? What determines prices when you have the case
of the market?
Well, it's demand together with the limitation of supply. There's only such and so much supply. There's not an infinite supply. We might imagine that this quantity A, I don't know how many previously owned automobiles are sold by individuals last year. I'm sure quite a few million. However many million it was, even if it's 10 million, that's all that there were. And if it's the case that there were only 10 million previously owned automobiles available for sale, and if it's the case that there are people out there who, between them, are potentially interested in acquiring more than 10 million, if they're potentially interested in acquiring 11 million or 15 million or whatever, what does that imply about the supply of these used cars.
Pardon me?
Or demand, you mean? Supply is low, demand's higher than supply.
The demand is greater than the supply, so the supply is scarce. The quantity that people would like to have exceeds the quantity that is available. So they're scarce. And because they're scarce and also very useful, that implies that they're going to have a price. And where is the price going to be?
Higher.
It'll be here at this point P1, indicated by E. The price is going to be up here. And what's going to put it there? The combination of the demand and the limited supply. And what's going to determine the price is the competition of the buyers. When you have something that is scarce, there isn't enough to satisfy all potential buyers. The buyers have to compete, and there are going to be some potential buyers who are going to be excluded from buying because the price is going to be too high for them. And that's how the price will be set. And in such cases, the subjective willingness of the sellers to accept much less or even to give their good away for nothing, that is simply irrelevant. The price is not determined by the subjective valuations of the sellers. It's determined by the fact that their supply is limited and the demand is potentially much greater. The demand is the potential quantity demanded exceeds the supply. And that is the situation with respect to labor. In this adjacent diagram, it's essentially the same situation. All we've done is change the labeling on the axes. Instead of price on the vertical, we have wage. And we allow for the fact that the workers, instead of being willing to work for absolutely nothing, they insist on obtaining at least minimum subsistence. Well, here's the minimum subsistence wage, but is the fact that the workers would be willing to work for as low as minimum subsistence, is that relevant to the wage they have to accept if their labor is scarce?
No.
Not at all. Again, the wage is going to be determined by the competition, this time of the employers, for the scarce supply of labor. The fact that the workers, if necessary, would be willing to accept subsistence, that's simply irrelevant. It's no more relevant than the owner of the car being willing to give it away for nothing. What's determining the wage in this case, or the price in the previous case, is the scarcity of the supply together with the demand. Now, there's more to say about this, and this is what I have in mind when I make a reference to the art auction. I now want to deal with the aspect of employer greed and just why the proposition that employers, like every other buyer, would prefer to pay less rather than more, why that is irrelevant. And the way to demonstrate the irrelevancy of that is to consider the example of an art auction, or some kind of auction for a rare item. Imagine that we have an auction proceeding, and we have two potential bidders. We have Mr. Say and Miss Gilmore. And Mr. Say, what's up for sale is this rare early printing of capitalism. Mr. Say is able and willing to bid up to $2,000. He would much prefer to pay only $200, or better than that, $20, or best of all, get it for nothing. Ms. Gilmore is able and willing to pay up to $1,000. Now, what happens if Mr. Say goes into the auction and recalls he'd rather pay $200 than $2,000, and therefore he insists on limiting his bid to $200 because he wants to pay less rather than more. Then Ms. Gilmore will get the good. Now, is that the outcome that Mr. Say wants?
No.
No. Okay, so what must he do if he wants to obtain the thing that he in fact values as highly as $2,000. He has to outbid Ms. Gilmore. And now, in order to outbid her, the lowest price that he can outbid her with would be $1,001. Now, this example contains an important modification, an important elaboration of what is the actual self-interest of a buyer, his rational self-interest. It is not to insist on obtaining the lowest price he would like or might imagine. It's to try to pay the lowest price that at the same time is simultaneously too high for his next nearest rival. The actual principle of the self-interest of a buyer is not to attempt to pay the lowest price he would like or might imagine, but the lowest price that is simultaneously too high for any other buyer who otherwise would obtain the good instead of him. That's his actual self-interest. And in this example, it would mean a price of $1,001. So the fact that he prefers to pay less rather than more, he's still going to have to pay a price that's above the highest bid of his nearest rival. And if at the same time the seller of this item were prepared to give it away for nothing, that's irrelevant. That's irrelevant. And Mr. Say's desire to pay the lowest he would like or might imagine, that's irrelevant too. What's going to determine the price is the price has to be high enough to knock out the next nearest rival, and that's going to be, in this case, above 1,000. Now, this is the situation with all scarce goods. The price has to be high enough to eliminate the competition of the next nearest rival, and that's the actual self-interest of the successful bidders. That's the price that they require. And the only difference between the labor market and our auction of one item is simply the number of units involved. Instead of having two bidders for one unit, we have well over 100 million workers in the American labor market. But how many potential jobs are there? Think back to our discussion early in the term. How much labor do we directly or indirectly require before our needs and desires could be sated? How much labor would you like to have the benefit of as a given individual? There's no limit. Certainly, we would each like to have the benefit of the labor of 5 or 10 others. That you could figure out how to do in a few seconds. But how much labor is there available to satisfy the needs and desires of the average member of any society? Well, suppose we imagine that this class constituted a self-contained economic system. And at the moment, there are perhaps 20 of us in the room. Now, each of us 20 would like the benefit of how much labor?
20.
Pardon me?
20.
Well, possibly 20, some substantial amount of labor. But if there are only 20 of us all together, how much labor can we perform among us? Can we do more than the labor of 20? No. So how much labor is available to go to the average member of this 20?
One.
The labor of just one. The maximum labor available to the average member of any society can never be more than the labor of one. And in reality, it's something significantly less because there are small children, there are old and infirm people, and so forth. And so the actual labor available to serve the needs and desires of the average member is significantly less than one. But at the same time, we would all like the labor of considerably more than one. So what does that mean about labor? Labor is scarce. There's a fundamental scarcity of labor. And on that basis, labor is going to have a price. There's going to have to be a wage that limits the quantity demanded of labor to the limited supply. And we're indicating the supply, the limitation of supply again as here. And it will be easy to show why the self-interest of employers will require, if this is the demand, the self-interest of employers will require the formation of a wage up here at this level, W sub 1. And we'll have this equilibrium wage. Now, why? Well, let's imagine for the moment that the wage were lower at W sub 2. So the wage is out here at W sub 2. If the wage is W sub 2, what's the quantity of labor demanded?
Lower.
Pardon me? Yes? Okay, the quantity demanded is out at B, and I label it L. L stands for lower zone, lower wage. All right, so the quantity demanded, instead of being limited to A, is at the greater point B. And that means there are people who will be employing labor at this lower wage of W sub 2, people who could not have afforded to employ labor at the higher wage of W sub 1, or not have afforded to employ as much labor. There's going to be people employing labor who otherwise could not have done so, and people employing a larger quantity of labor than they otherwise would have if the wage is down at W sub 2. Well, to the extent that the employers in this lower zone, to the extent that employers in this lower zone succeed in finding workers at the wage W sub 2, and the simplest case is to imagine that they obtain a quantity of labor equal to AB. Employers in this zone employ a quantity of labor equal to AB at the wage W sub 2. What does that do to the quantity of labor available for the other employers who are able and willing to pay the higher wage of W sub 1 and who are willing to pay even higher wages, most of them? What does that do to the supply of labor available for them?
Decrease.
How much is the labor available for them reduced if employers in this lower zone are employing the quantity AB? What does that imply about the labor available for the other employers? If the total labor is equal to A, and the quantity AB is employed by employers in this lower zone, what is implied by the quantity of what is implied for the quantity available for the other employers?
B.
Pardon me?
B.
No, B is out here. AB is employed in this zone. The total quantity is still A. Here's AB shuffled off to here.
It's the total minus
A minus B. It's AB subtracted from A, and if AC is equal to AB, it's drawn that way, the quantity that's going to be available for the other employers is equivalently reduced. So what remains for the employers able and willing to pay the wage of W1 is this smaller quantity of labor just at C. If altogether there's only B, or only A, and AB is going to a particular group, then there's an equivalently reduced quantity available for other employers. And these other employers are willing and able to pay how much?
More than W2.
More than W2. They're willing and able to pay from W1 on up to W3, in fact. Well, what we can identify here is this is a group of employers whose position is essentially the same as Mr. Say's was at our auction if he refused to raise his bid. If Mr. Say allows a bid within the range that Ms. Gilmore can afford, then Mr. Say is going to walk away empty-handed, but he's able and willing to pay more, so and he wants the thing, so what does his self-interest dictate? To raise the bid. Well, that's the position of employers over here. These are the Mr. Say employers, and these are the Ms. Gilmore employers. And if the labor is going to go to the Ms. Gilmore employers at lower wages, that means Mr. Say can't find the labor he wants and is able and willing to pay more for. So what is his self-interest at this point if he sees he can't get the workers he wants? To raise the wage. And by doing so, he will knock the Ms. Gilmore employers out of the market. So when you have a scarcity of labor, the self-interest of employers operates to bid wage rates up in order to avoid not being able to obtain the labor they want. And why do wages ever rise? Can you conceive of a wage increase not brought about by legislation or unions?
Only when the labor is scarce.
Pardon me?
Only when the labor is scarce.
When the category of labor is scarce and employers find they have a hard time gaining or keeping the labor they need. At that point, they start raising wages. What would the company you work for do if it found that it was losing too many employees, having a hard time replacing them, not able to increase the number that it wanted to? They would raise the wages. And doing that serves to eliminate the competition of other employers not able or willing to pay as much. So the point here is that the actual nature of the self-interest of employers is for wages to be high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the supply of labor available. Wages in a free market are high enough to reflect the underlying scarcity of labor, to limit the quantity demanded to the supply available. And that is the actual self-interest of employers, to pay the lowest wages they can, consistent with those wages simultaneously being too high for other employers to meet. And the willingness of the workers to accept the minimum subsistence is simply irrelevant here. The wages that they have to accept are determined by the scarcity of labor and the competition of the employers. Now, there are situations where the self-interest of employers will drive down wage rates. And that would be if we started at a wage up here at this higher level, W sub 3. If this were the wage, all right, what would be the quantity of labor demanded? Just C, but the supply available is greater, right? Now, in these circumstances, employers are in a position to say to their present employees, there are unemployed workers who can do your job as well as you can, and at the same time, if these unemployed workers need to work, what kind of wages are they willing to take?
Less.
They're willing to work for less than W sub 3. They might be willing to work for as little as M. They're certainly willing to work for less than W sub 3. And the employer is able to say to his present employees, you guys have to take a cut because I can find unemployed workers who are willing to do your jobs for less than you are. So in those circumstances, what's going to happen to the prevailing level of wage rates? They will drop, but now as they do, as wage rates descend from W3 down toward W1, what happens to the quantity of labor demanded? It will increase, and then it comes to an end. The decrease comes to an end. At what point?
W1.
When the quantity of labor demanded is equal to the supply available of A, and at that point the fall in wage rates ends. If it went any further, well, we'd be back to where we were just a moment ago, we'd have a labor shortage. We'd have a labor shortage at a wage below W1. The self-interest of employers would bid it back up. If we have a wage above W1, the self-interest of employers and the unemployed workers operates to drive wages down. And the end result of it is it eliminates unemployment. Wages decline not towards subsistence, but to the point of eliminating the unemployment. Yes, come on.
Is it fair to say this theory can be applied in a greater division of labor society?
Say that again?
Is it fair to say that this theory can be only applied to a greater division of labor society?
Can this theory only be applied to a
greater division of labor society?
A greater division of labor society. Well, it certainly applies in a free economy, in a free market economy.
Yeah. But the question is, if there's a lesser division of labor for countries like India or some other countries, supply will be higher.
All right, if you have an economy where people are still largely living in a self-sufficient way, then you don't have a labor market to start with, so it wouldn't be an issue of money wage rates. These would be people working as self-sufficient farmers. So there isn't a, we're not talking about a labor market there.
Okay.
Okay. Now, in other words, in a free market, there's potential for wage rates to decline when you have a situation of unemployment, but then the effect is to eliminate the unemployment. And incidentally, while we're at it here, if you want to know what causes unemployment to be a long-term continuing phenomenon, as it is right now in many of the countries of Western Europe, well, can anyone take a guess?
Artificially high wage rates
caused by government intervention behind powerful labor unions, all kinds of fringe benefits. When we talk about wage rates, you should realize that that includes everything that appears as a cost of employment to the employer. You might have a situation where a worker takes home a relatively modest sum, but if piled on top of that, there's all kinds of employer contributions for old age pensions, for medical care, for child care, for family leave, for long vacations, one thing and another. That's all part of the cost of employment, and it represents part of the wage from the perspective of the employer. Okay, well, to sum this up, or at least a major aspect of it, I say simply, labor is useful and scarce, and money wage rates fall no lower than corresponds to the point of full employment. And this is occupation by occupation, place by place. So it's not necessary that we have to deal with the full employment in the entire economic system, but the wage rates of carpenters in Des Moines, for example, will fall no lower than would correspond to the full employment of carpenters in Des Moines. The wage rates of plumbers in St. Louis would fall no lower than corresponds to the full employment of plumbers in St. Louis, and so on. And at these points, the scarcity of labor is felt. And wage rates then can't go any lower, because if they were to, you'd have a quantity of labor demanded greater than the supply available, you'd have a labor shortage. And let me point out, incidentally, that the actual self-interest of employers is such that when confronted with a labor shortage, they will actually conspire with the workers to raise wage rates, even in violation of the spirit of the law. And there was actually a case of this kind not all that long ago. Under the Carter administration, for example, there were wage price guidelines. Carter was attempting to limit the rise in prices by telling employers not to raise wage rates more than, I think, 6% a year. They were rising pretty generally at low double-digit rates. And Carter thought that by restraining the rise in wages and prices, they would moderate the problem of inflation. Well, had employers followed the guidelines, if the market is dictating 10% annual wage increases and they're only offering 6% annual increases, they're not going to get the labor they want. Labor is going to be too cheap, and there'll be employers not able and willing to pay 10% more, but who are able to pay 6% more, they'll be getting labor, and employers able and willing to pay more won't be, and they'll be suffering from the shortage. Well, in that environment, the way employers evaded the spirit of these regulations was to hand out large numbers of phony promotions. See, the law would say You can raise wages 6% for any given type of work. It doesn't mean you can't pay a higher grade of labor more money than a lower grade. And so imagine we have two different grades of labor. One at the time was getting $10 an hour, another was getting $12 an hour. Well, if and you're only allowed to raise them 6%, well, that's a 60-cent raise in one and a 72-cent raise in the other. But if in the meanwhile you promote some people from the one grade to the other, you have the ability to raise their wages much more than the 6% allowed. And that practice was widely followed as a means of getting around the wage controls, because that was the actual self-interest of the employers. And also a further bit of evidence along these lines, just consider, why are the wages of skilled workers higher than those of unskilled workers?
Requires more training and skills?
They're scarce. There's a greater degree of scarcity relative to the demand. And the market makes the employers pay the higher wages. Now, the skilled workers would be willing to take minimum subsistence, too. They certainly don't have to, nor do the unskilled workers in a modern economy. Now, let me point out, and this is now point three, that a drop in wage rates to the full employment point does not mean that we would achieve subsistence wages by the back door, so to speak. You might think, well, okay, it isn't the case of the arbitrary power of the capitalists. That's not going to set wages at minimum subsistence. But mightn't it be the case that simply as a condition of achieving full employment, we know that if we have unemployment, what must happen to wages? In a free market, if there's unemployment, wage rates are going to go down. Well, mightn't it be possible, you could think, that simply reflecting the state of demand and supply, mightn't it be the case that in order to eliminate the unemployment, wage rates need to go down to such an extent that we end up, in effect, with subsistence, just because that's the way things are, not because the employers arbitrarily set wage rates at subsistence, but that's just the state of demand and supply. But I'd like to explain why that is next to impossible in any modern economic system, totally impossible. And this is because the effect of a fall in wage rates that is required to eliminate unemployment has some further related effects. First of all, what will be the effect as unemployment diminishes and more workers are employed? What's the effect on production? Production is going up, and what's the effect on unit costs of the fall in wage rates? The unit costs are going down, and the supply of products produced is going up. Now, either way, whether you're thinking of prices as determined by supply and demand or on the basis of costs of production, what is the indication for prices? That prices should be going down, too. So the fact that wage rates have to fall to eliminate unemployment does not, in fact, imply that wage rates are headed towards subsistence, because it is also, at the same time, operating to drive down costs of production and prices. And here we need to introduce the concept of real wages. I think we probably referred to real wages earlier in the term. I'm sure we have, in fact. What is a real wage as opposed to a mere nominal or money wage? What's a real wage as opposed to a mere nominal or money wage? Yes, Mr. Underwood?
Is it the goods and services that you can actually purchase?
Yeah, it's the goods and services that a wage earner can actually buy with the money he earns. So it's a very important distinction. you can never know anything about real wages or the worker's standard of living if you're looking just at the amount of money he earns.
So is it fair to say then real wages, nominal wage minus inflation?
Well, real wages have to be adjusted for inflation. A good way to think of real wages is the relationship between the average money wage and the price level. A real wage is reflected in the relationship between the money a wage earner is paid and the prices of the goods and services he has to pay. And it's only by knowing both prices and wages that you're in a position to judge real wages. Today, we would think anyone who's earning $1 million a year, well, he is fabulously well off. But we only think that because we're taking for granted the prevailing level of prices. There could very easily come a time when people might be miserably poor earning $1 million a year. In fact, we can reverse the example. At one time, earning $10,000 a year was an extremely good wage. But prices at that time were a small fraction of what they are today. If the price of a decent new house was $10,000 and you earned $10,000 a year, meaning you could buy a new house with the equivalent of 1 year's income, well, that was a pretty fantastic income. If a new car cost $1,000 and you're earning $10,000, well, that's another indication of how good an income $10,000 was. If a steak in a restaurant, in a good restaurant, were $1 and you're earning $10,000 a year, that's yet another indication. Well, with today's level of prices, earning $10,000 a year is below the poverty line. And it's entirely possible that before we're too much further into this century, certainly by the midpoint of the century, earning $1 million a year will be a pretty low income. I don't know how many of you recall prices and incomes in Italian lira before 1999 and the change over to the euro, but everything cost millions of lira. You can spend $1 million for a hotel stay, one night stay in a decent hotel. So everyone in Italy was earning millions and millions of lira. You could still be poor. To know real wages, we always have to have one eye on prices and only one eye on money wages. Now, when you have a reduction in money wages as the result of unemployment, and the reduction in the money wages is serving to eliminate the unemployment, in that context, we should not expect a decline in real wages. There's a decline in money wages, but the same process of more people being employed at lower unit costs, at lower wage rates, well, that will mean the costs of production are down and the supply of goods is up, and these are factors operating to drive prices down. And as a matter of fact, it is not at all unreasonable to assume that prices may very well fall to the exact same extent as wage rates. And we can see that in the light of these two formulas here under point four, stating that real wages depend on the productivity of labor, i.e. the output per worker or the output per unit of labor. And let's examine these two formulas. We have the average money wage rate, and it's equal to a numerator divided by a denominator. And the numerator is the demand for labor expressed as total payrolls. And now we're using the concept of demand as the classical economists did in the sense of an amount of expenditure, total payrolls. Now, the average money wage rate, expressed here on an annual basis, the average money wage per worker per year could be found by taking the total payrolls in the economy, which are now in the trillions of dollars, and dividing by the number of workers employed. To take a hypothetical illustration, suppose we had an economy in which total payrolls were $1 trillion and the total number of workers employed was 100 million. What would be the average annual wage per worker per year? It would be $10,000. $10,000. All right, now, and we have this other formula, the general consumer price level equals the demand for consumers' goods in the sense of the amount of money spent to buy them divided by the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold. Just to grasp the truth of this formula, suppose we wanted to express the average price at which a bottle of water such as this is sold downstairs in the Pepperdine bookstore. And suppose your assignment was calculate the average price at which they sold one of these bottles of water over the last week. What information would you need to know?
How many of what price?
How many of them they sold, and what else?
Price.
Well, that's how many they sold.
The price they sold.
Well, that we want to find the average price at which they sold it. What information would you need so that we could calculate the average price at which the bottles they sold were sold?
What are the different prices?
Yes?
Total revenue.
The revenue, the amount of money spent to buy these bottles divided by the quantity sold. So if you knew, for example, that over the course of the last week, people spent $100 buying these bottles of soda and 100 bottles were sold, well then you'd know the average price at which a bottle was sold was $1. Now, the same principle would apply to any other good. If I ask you, calculate the average price at which a new Honda Accord was sold at the nearest Honda dealership over the last month, what information would you need?
The quantity sold and the amount spent to buy them.
Yeah, the amount spent to buy them, however many hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars divided by the number of units sold. Now, you can do this for any good, for any period of time. And we can also do it with a little more difficulty for the totality of goods. It's not difficult to conceive of the total amount of money spent to buy all the different goods in the whole economy, all the consumers' goods. We can reasonably well add up the total number of dollars spent to buy new houses, new automobiles, new television sets, groceries, shoes, all of the different consumers' goods. We can arrive at a total amount, and this is close to the gross domestic product. Its consumption expenditure accounts for perhaps 85% of the gross domestic product, if you count the government's consumption. There is some difficulty in how do we state the supply of houses, carrots, cars, and television sets, how do we aggregate them to get them into the denominator? But one way or another, we can do it. Different methods, you might argue back and forth about which is a better or a poorer method, but it is done, we can do it. And I think all of us do it in one way or another. For example, if I were to ask you the question, is the total supply of goods produced in the United States today larger than it was in 1950?
Yes.
Would you have any hesitation in answering yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we all agree to that. Is the total supply of goods produced in the United States today larger than the total supply produced in Canada today?
Yes.
Again, yes. But now notice, is the supply of each and every good produced today in the United States, is that a uniform multiple of the supply that was produced in 1954? Or isn't it the case that there may have been some goods produced in 1954 that we no longer produce at all, and there are many goods produced today that we didn't produce at all in 1954, and the goods that we did produce then and still produce now, we don't produce in a uniform multiple. There are some things that we produce 10% more of, other things that we produce 500% more of, some things that we produce somewhat less of. But nevertheless, we do get around the hurdle of clearly understanding that the total adds up to more today than it did then. Now, it's only a question of how we'll express the different totals. But I think there is no doubt that we do conceive things this way. And the general consumer price level is to be conceived of as the total amount of money spent to buy the total mass of goods produced and sold, divided by the quantity of them produced and sold, however we would end up expressing that quantity. We have to express the overall quantity in terms of some number of units, but whatever the units we select, the general consumer price level will equal that number of units divided into the amount of money spent to buy them. And that's how we can conceive of the general consumer price level. All right, now in that framework, we can analyze the effects of a fall in wage rates required to achieve full employment. And we'll do so on two simplifying assumptions. We'll assume that these two numerators, the demands, are unchanged. We'll assume the total aggregate demand for labor is unchanged at however many trillions or hundreds of billions it might be. And the total demand for consumers' goods is unchanged, too. It's somewhat larger, but we'll assume that it is unchanged. All right, imagine that we started out, we had 10% unemployment. We have a general unemployment rate of 10%. Would it be possible for the same total payrolls to employ the 10% of the workers who are unemployed in addition to the 90% who are employed?
Possibly.
What would have to happen in order for the same total payrolls, let's say they're $100 trillion, what would be required for the same total payrolls to employ 10/9 the quantity of labor they now employ? I say 10/9 because if we have 9 in 10 workers working already, and we have 1 in 10 not working, well, how will full employment compare to the present 90% of full employment? What would be the ratio of the new quantity of labor employed to the present quantity? What's the ratio of 10 workers working for every 9 who presently work? 10/9. Okay, what would be necessary for 10/9 the workers to be employed for the same total payrolls? What's implied about the average money wage rate? To what extent would it need to go down? Yes, Kumar?
10%.
Okay, roughly 10%. It would have to be 9/10. This way I won't have to write on the screen. We could have 10/9 the workers employed at 9/10 the average money wage rate. Now, what would be the effect if we have 10/9 the workers employed? And what would be the effect on the output of consumers' goods if they have the same output per worker?
Increase by 10.
What would be the ratio of increase in the supply of consumers' goods? We have 10 workers working for every 9 who used to work, and they're producing the same output per man. And how many do 10 produce compared to 9?
10/9.
Okay, so the supply of consumers' goods produced should be expected to soon rise in the ratio of 10/9. And if we have an unchanged demand for consumers' goods, I'll put an asterisk in, have unchanged demands, what should be the effect on the general consumer price level?
Go down.
Go down to what extent? If we're dividing an unchanged numerator by a denominator that's 10/9 as large, then the price level should be 9/10 also. Well, what is implied if wages are 9/10, but also prices are 9/10, what's implied about real wages? That real wages are unchanged, that they're actually unchanged. Now, there's a further factor that implies that there's an aspect of real wages that actually rise. And I say that in point 3. Real wages actually rise with the elimination of unemployment. Not only are there lower prices corresponding to the lower wages, but also there's the elimination of the burden of supporting the unemployed. Just think, when you have unemployment, who is supporting the unemployed? Are they just left to starve in the streets? Well, in the first instance, today, certainly it's the government, but where does the government get the means to provide for them? By taxes, the bulk of which land or even directly paid by the average wage and salary earner. And to the extent that the government is not involved, there are people who would be helping out an unemployed friend or brother or sister or whatever. So the unemployed are supported overwhelmingly at the expense of the workers who are employed. And when you have a fall in wage rates that eliminates the unemployment and also drives down prices to pretty much the same extent as wage rates, the net effect is the elimination of the burden of supporting the unemployed, which will mean a rise in real take-home wages. And to illustrate this idea, with small numbers, we don't have to waste brain space with unnecessary zeros. Imagine that initially the average wage were $100 a week, and you're buying at the initial price level. And but out of your $100 a week, you're paying $5 a week toward the support of the unemployed. So your take-home wage is $95. All right, now we have 10% unemployment, and the result is your take-home wage, instead of being $100, your gross wage, instead of being $100, is going to be $90. And prices are going to end up being 90% of what they were. Well, how much has your take-home wage fallen? Your gross wage has fallen $10 from $100 to $90, but your take-home wage used to be not $100, it was $95. And what is your take-home wage now?
$90.
So how much has it fallen?
Five.
It's fallen from 5 out of 95. And where is there a greater fall? Is it in your take-home wages or in prices?
Prices
have fallen more than your take-home wage, so your actual real take-home wage increases by virtue of the elimination of the burden of supporting the unemployed. Now, just to assure you that this does not depend on any special arithmetic, let's move the example to the conditions of a desert island. And let's assume that we have 10 shipwrecked sailors. And they will have to produce everything they consume. It's like an extended Robinson Crusoe setup, Robinson Crusoe naval crew. And I'll imagine that one of these 10 sailors has broken a leg. So he's laid up and can't work for a while. Well, presumably, the other 9 sailors who are still able to work, they'll be taking care of the 10th one who's unable to work. What will be the effect on the standard of living of those 9 when the 10th one recovers and can go back to work and support himself?
Improves.
The standard of living of the other 9 will go up. That's the basic principle. They no longer have to support him. He supports himself. They're in a position to keep more of what they earn. Now, we can move from there back to a modern economy by assuming that on this desert island, somehow they had money, and we'll assume there's a fixed quantity of payrolls, and it's the same whether 9 sailors are working or 10 sailors are working. When the 10 sailors work, the average wage falls in the ratio of 9 to 10, and output goes up in the ratio of 10 to 9. And prices fall in the ratio of 9 to 10. We're assuming there's money to buy the output, and this it's unchanged. But we have 10 ninths the output, so again, there'll be 9 tenths the prices. What's the net gain? It's still not having to support the previously unemployed sailor. All right, well now, this demonstration of why the drop in wage rates required to eliminate unemployment should not be assumed to mean a drop in real wages, but on the contrary, in this case, a rise in real take-home wages. We can go a lot further than this. We'll be in a position to understand real wages generally. And we can work a number of cases. What I'll be able to show here is that what determines real wages, by far the most important determinant of the average level of real wages in any economy, what's determining it is not what the government is doing, not what the unions are doing, not anything negative that the terrible greedy capitalists are doing. What is determining real wages is the general productivity of labor. How much does the average worker produce per hour? How much does the average worker produce per hour or per any other unit of time? And we can see this in terms of these two formulas. Let me bring this down ever so slightly. And we'll examine a number of cases, and then we'll proceed to a very simple algebraic demonstration. And the point here is to show how the productivity of labor is what determines real wages, how it's the output per worker that determines the general level of real wages. And our first case is A, where we assume the money supply, and thus the monetary demands, the amount of expenditures for labor and consumers' goods, we're assuming that that's constant. That population and the number of people working, that's also constant. The only thing that's varying is the output per worker. And to make our work as simple as possible, we'll assume that we have a period in view that is long enough for the average productivity of labor to double. So the productivity of labor has doubled. We have asterisk indicating an unchanged demand for labor. We also have an unchanged supply of labor employed, indicating using an asterisk to indicate constancy. We have an unchanged demand for consumers' goods. If the output per worker on average has doubled and we have the same number of workers working, what should be the effect on the total supply of goods in the economy? They should double. They should double. All right, if you have to sell double the supply of goods for the same total expenditure of money, what will be the effect on prices?
Prices will drop.
Prices will drop by half. We have two times the supply of consumers' goods divided into the same spending to buy them. That implies prices are halved. And if we have the same money wage rate, this is equal to the demand for labor, that's fixed, over the supply of labor employed, that's fixed. So the average money wage is fixed. But if the price level is equal to the demand for consumers' goods, over two times the supply of consumers' goods, well then the price level is halved. And what has happened to wages over prices? This is the average real wage. If this is halved, what's happened to the average real wage? That's doubled. The average real wage is doubled. So here we are, we have a case doubling the productivity of labor doubles the average real wage. And it's working here by virtue of halving prices. Now, we don't normally think of real wages going up by virtue of prices going down. How do we normally think of the standard of living rising?
More money.
People earning more money. And we'll examine that case next. Now we'll assume that we have an increase in the quantity of money. There's more money, there'll be more spending. We'll assume that we have a doubling in the quantity of money, a doubling in the amount of spending, both to employ labor and to buy goods. What will keep the same is population and the number of people working and the productivity of labor. This time, we're assuming there's no rise in the productivity of labor. And again, there's no increase in the population. So the supply of labor employed is the same. If we have twice the the quantity of labor demand, twice the amount of money spent to employ labor, twice the payrolls. And we have the same supply of labor. What's implied about the average money wage? It'll double. But the same doubling of money and spending also serves to double the demand for consumers' goods. Now, if we have simply the same number of people working, and it's the same output per worker, what's happened to the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold? We have the same number of people working, and it's the same output per worker. What's implied about the quantity of output produced and sold?
Unchanged.
It's unchanged. But we have twice the spending to buy the same output, so what's happened to prices?
Doubles.
They're doubled. Well, if the money wage doubles and prices double, what's happened to real wages?
No change.
There's no change. Real wages are unchanged. The same factor that allows everybody to earn twice the money by itself would also drive up prices by double, and real wages would not be increased. Now, what would be more familiar to us, what we're counting on, is that when money wages rise, we're expecting that prices won't rise, or at least not rise as much. Well, what would be necessary so that we could have money wages doubling and prices being unchanged? Well, that's case C. And case C is the money supply and productivity rising, population, and thus the number of workers employed being the same. And let's work that case. Okay, here we are, we have twice the quantity of money. So there's two times the demand for labor. We have an unchanged supply of labor employed. What's the effect on money wage rates?
Double.
Okay, they double. And what's the effect on the demand for consumers' goods if we have twice the quantity of money, twice the spending?
Doubles.
That doubles. But if the productivity of labor has doubled, what will be the effect on the supply of goods if we have the same number of people working, only they're working with an average double productivity of labor? We have the same number of people working, and each on average produces double. What's the total production?
Double.
It's double. Okay, well, if we have twice the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold, or twice the amount of money spent to buy them, what's the effect on the general consumer price level?
No change.
It's unchanged. Here's our situation. Wages double and prices are unchanged. But what is it that allows prices to be unchanged while the volume of spending is doubling?
Productivity.
As productivity has served to increase the supply, it's doubled the supply while the quantity of money, the doubling of money, has doubled the demand. Now notice what's happened here is we have doubled the money in spending. Double the money in spending, in effect, washes up against an unchanged supply of labor. So when double the spending meets an unchanged supply of labor, what's it do to wage rates? When double the money in spending comes up against an unchanged supply of labor, what does it do to wage rates?
It doubles.
It doubles it. But the doubled money in spending washes up against a doubled supply of consumers' goods. So when you have double the spending coming up against double the supply, what's the effect on prices?
No change.
No change. Now, what keeps prices unchanged, what allows wage rates to rise while prices don't, the only thing that makes that possible is this increase in the productivity of labor. And notice further, what is still the way the productivity of labor is contributing to prices being unchanged? See, there are two factors at work making prices unchanged. Yeah, one is the doubling of the demand. By itself, what would that do to prices? What did we see it do a few minutes ago?
The prices would go up.
The prices would go up, specifically they would double. What's the effect in isolation of the doubled supply of consumers' goods?
Now prices go up.
Pardon me?
They cancel each other out, so they're unchanged.
They end up being unchanged, but I'm asking, what's the specific contribution of the doubling of supply?
Prices go 50% down.
The prices are halved. Now prices end up being unchanged because there are two equal opposite forces. One is operating to double prices. That's the increase in money and spending. That's what doubles wages. The other is operating to halve prices. When you put the two together, prices end up being unchanged. Now notice the rise in the productivity of labor is still operating from the side of making prices lower. If prices end up being unchanged instead of being doubled, they'd be doubled if this were all that were at work. They end up being unchanged because we're adding into this situation that would double prices, we're adding in this other factor that's operating to halve them. The doubling of the productivity of labor is still making prices half, but half this time not compared to what they were, but half compared to what they otherwise would have been. If we only had more money in spending, what would have happened to prices? If we had only had doubled money in spending, what would have happened to prices?
Doubles.
They would have doubled. Instead, they end up unchanged. Why? Because the doubling of the productivity of labor is halving them from double. If you have something that would have doubled, the result is unchanged. And notice, the rise in the productivity of labor is always operating to raise wage rates It's operating to raise real wage rates from the side of making goods cheaper. The rise in the productivity of labor is operating to raise real wage rates by making goods cheaper. Now, we could elaborate this still further. We could drop the assumption of the population being constant. We could allow over a period of years, let's assume the population and the labor force double. We can work that case. Assuming now this is D, money supply and productivity are both constant. The only thing going on is the increase in population, and it's taking the form. It's showing up as a larger supply of labor. Now we've actually, yes, Mr. Feldman.
Can you just repeat that statement, the rise of the productivity of labor increases the real wages, how that
end? The rise in the productivity of labor raises real wages from the side of making the prices of goods less. Real wages go up, not by virtue of people earning more money, but by virtue of the prices of goods being lower, lower than they otherwise would have been. I know this is counterintuitive, but this is actually the way it does work. You see, there are two processes going on at the same time. On the one side, we have an expanding quantity of money and an expanding volume of spending, and that's raising everybody's money income. That's what's raising people's wages. But that's not what's raising the standard of living. What's raising the standard of living is the rise in the productivity of labor, which serves to raise the standard of living by preventing prices from going up as much as they would have had the only thing operative been the increase in money and spending. All right, now, here we are. We're going to assume that over a period of years, perhaps a generation or more, the supply of labor employed doubles. If we had an unchanged demand for labor, what would be implied about the average money wage in order for the same payrolls to employ twice the people? The average money wage would have to halve. If the productivity of labor is unchanged, what would be the effect on the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold? It should double. We have twice the people, each producing the same. And the demand for consumers' goods is unchanged. All right, what's the effect on the general consumer price level?
It's half.
It's half. What's the effect on real wages?
Unchanged.
Okay, now we can assume that not only is the population going up, but also the productivity of labor. So what would happen if over, let's say, a generation, once again, the supply of labor employed doubles, the demand for labor remains the same, the demand for consumers' goods remains the same, but now, in addition to twice the workers working, they're working with twice the productivity, twice the output per worker. What would be the effect on the supply of consumers' goods produced and sold?
That'll be four times.
Twice because of more people, and twice because of more output per worker. So what will be the effect on the price level?
1/4.
It'll be 1/4, and the wage level is 1/2. What's the implication for real wages if the average money wage is half, but the price level is 1/4? Real wages, again, have doubled with the productivity of labor. Now, finally, the last case would be everything is changing together. We have more people, the productivity of labor is rising, and the quantity of money and volume of spending also. So let's say over a period of years, the quantity of money and volume of spending doubles, the supply of labor also doubles, the demand for consumers' goods doubles, and the supply of consumers' goods quadruples. Why would it quadruple when the quantity of labor employed merely doubled?
Because productivity of supply is doubled.
Because the productivity of labor doubled. We have twice the workers with twice the productivity. All right, what's the effect on the average money wage?
Unchanged.
What's the effect on the price level?
Half.
It's half. What's the effect on real wages?
Half. 50% raise.
If the average money wage is unchanged and prices are halved,
It's doubled.
The real wage doubles with the doubling of the productivity of labor. Now, if the quantity of money increased more than this, imagine the quantity of money rose by a factor of 4 rather than 2, then what's the effect on the average money wage?
Half.
We have 4 times the
output.
It doubles. And we have 4 times the demand for consumers' goods. What's the effect on the price level?
Unchanged.
So what's the effect on real wages if money wages double and the price level is unchanged?
Doubled.
They're doubled. And the rise in the productivity of labor is still the underlying factor. Now, we can demonstrate this algebraically, that it's the productivity of labor. It's actually a pretty simple demonstration. W is the average money wage rate, P is the general consumer price level, D sub L, D sub C, S sub L, S sub C. Right, we start off, the first equation is the average real wage, what the worker's money wage actually buys. It can be expressed as the average money wage divided by the general consumer price level, W divided by P. So if the average money wage is $100 a week and the price level is at one thing, that signifies some definite average real wage. But the average money wage in turn is equal to the total payrolls divided by the number of workers employed. That's what we've been working with. The general consumer price level is equal to the spending to buy consumers' goods, D sub Z, demand for consumers' goods, divided by the supply produced and sold. Well, all we do here is we substitute equations 2 and 3 into 1. So instead of saying W, we say D sub L over S sub L, right over there. Instead of saying P, we say D sub C over S sub C. So we have the average real wage, W over P, is equal to D sub L over S sub L, payrolls divided by supply of labor employed, divided by demand for consumers' goods divided by supply of consumers' goods. That's the general consumer price level. Well, when you divide by a fractional expression, what rule do you have to follow? Invert and multiply. So that brings us to step five. The average real wage is equal to the demand for labor divided by the supply of labor, payrolls over a number of workers employed, times this time the supply of consumers' goods divided by the demand for consumers' goods. And finally, all we do in equation six is change the order of multiplication. Instead of multiplying S sub L times D sub C, we multiply D sub C times S sub L. And we simply change their places in the denominator. It's like saying, instead of multiplying 5/7 times 3/5, we multiply 5/5 times 3/7. It's the same thing. But when we do that, we have now the average real wage is equal to the product of these two expressions. This second expression represents the productivity of labor. The expression supply of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor, that means the output per worker. How do we get a supply of consumers' goods that becomes greater relative to the supply of labor? What's determining that relationship at any given time? Suppose I tell you we have five workers and they're producing 10 pounds of potatoes. The 10 pounds would be the S sub C, the supply of consumers' goods. The five workers would be the S sub L. Does that imply anything about the output per worker?
Double.
Well, it implies the average productivity is 2. There's 2 units per worker. 10 units of output over 5 workers. All right, suppose we have 10 trillion units of output over 100 million workers. Does that have any mathematical implication? Well, I think it would be 10,000 per worker, if my arithmetic serves me correctly. That would be the productivity of labor. Well, what this reduces to, the average real wage is equal to the product of the productivity of labor, which is expressed by the fraction SC over SL, that's the output of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor, the output of consumers' goods relative to the supply of labor, times this first expression, the demand for labor divided by the demand for consumers' goods, payrolls divided by consumer spending. Now let's just take a moment to think about what that signifies. Where does most consumer spending come from? What's the source? From payrolls. Payrolls are, in a modern economy, far and away the main source of consumer spending. Well, the demand for consumers' goods is almost always larger than payrolls because there are some other significant sources of consumption over and above payrolls. There are such things as dividend payments. Partnerships and proprietorships have draw payments. And there are also interest payments. So the payment of dividends, draw, and interest provides a source of consumption that has to be added to the consumption coming from the wage earners. And that serves to make total consumption somewhat larger than wages. But real wages are in part the reflection of this relationship between payrolls and total consumer spending. The larger are payrolls relative to total consumer spending, the higher would be real wages. But there isn't very much potential there, and hasn't been for many generations. Already, payrolls are probably on the order of perhaps 90% of total consumer spending, which would mean at most, you might increase it by another roughly 10%. See, there's an absolute limit. You could not have payrolls even equal to consumer spending as a long-run permanent proposition, because there are other necessary parties in the economic system, and they have to consume too. So there's a maximum upper limit to the ratio of payrolls to consumer spending that is something below 1. And they're already a very high fraction and have been for quite a few generations, which means that this is not a significant source of a rise in real wages and hasn't been for a very long time. What then is the overwhelming source of being able to raise real wages? What is the item that has the real potential? The rise in the productivity of labor. Okay,